You're listening to PX Pulse, a regular podcast bringing you fresh voices on critical issues facing HIV prevention research today. Several studies looking into a cure for HIV are currently exploring questions about the latent reservoir of HIV that hides in the body, even when treatment has brought HIV in the bloodstream to undetectable levels. When people are on antiretrovirals and suppressing the virus, it often can't be found in the blood. In the vast majority of people, when treatment is stopped, the virus bounces back, showing up in the bloodstream once again. Scientists are looking at how to stop this rebound. Some studies involve taking people off antiretroviral treatment while giving them other agents that might control the rebound. All of this is done under close observation. Treatment interruption studies like these aren't completely new in the field of HIV. But this specific approach, known as analytic treatment interruption, or ATI, needs a very close look from lots of angles. Are the trials safe, ethical, feasible? In this episode of PX Pulse, scientists and advocates wrestle with these questions against the backdrop of a deeply felt hope among so many that a cure can one day be found. Dr. Stephen Deeks is leading some of the cure studies. I asked him to explain the role of analytic treatment interruption and its risks.
In the cure research environment, we are going to be doing things that will either get rid of the virus that's there, or more likely, make the immune system more likely to control whatever virus is there. And so we're going to be doing these types of manipulations in people during treatment to try to actually achieve a cure. But at the end of the day, you know, you don't really know whether anything you're doing is working unless you stop drugs. Because by definition, a cure will actually allow people to stop drugs and do well in the absence of therapy. And the only way to actually prove that that's going to happen is to ask people to stop therapy, which is, as you implied here, a bit risky, depending on how it's done. The main risk is that when the virus rebounds, it can rebound in a pretty dramatic manner and cause people to get like a flu-like syndrome or even worse from the virus itself. And the other big risk, the one that that we worry about, is that when the virus does go up, when you stop therapy, people are much more likely to be able to transmit that virus to their partners and so forth. So we go out of our way to try to mitigate against both of those risks.
So do you think we should be conducting treatment interruptions right now, given what we know? And tell us why or why not.
In clinical care or in your traditional treatment type of research studies, there's no reason to stop therapy. But in a very controlled research setting of cure-related interventions, we have no choice. We don't have the capacity in many situations to figure out exactly what we're doing unless we stop therapy. So if the research agenda in a cure arena is going to move forward, then we have to figure out how best to do these interruptions. I don't think it's really negotiable. And I think most people now, there's some exceptions, but most experts now believe that yes, indeed, these interruptions, if done carefully and with proper informed consent, have to be done.
There are voices in the cure research field of HIV who are raising concerns about ATI, treatment interruption. How do you characterize those concerns, and what's your response?
The main pushback from those that don't think we should be doing these interruptions is that we do indeed now have measurements that could be done in people on therapy that are informative, and that we can do these cure-related research studies, make those measurements while people are on treatment, and the field will progress.
Let me just interject here. The measurements we're talking about is the size of the population of latent HIV. Is that one of the things that's
Yes.
able to be measured while someone's on treatment? So the argument then is we don't have to take them off treatment to see whether this new intervention that's supposed to be related to a therapeutic cure of some sort is having the desired impact, which would be a smaller reservoir of latent HIV. That's the argument?
That's the argument. And my counter argument is that twofold. First, those measurements are done in blood and don't really tell us what's happening in the whole body and are not that accurate. And second, and far more importantly, many of the curative studies that we're doing these days have nothing to do with the size of the reservoir. They assume that the reservoir will remain stable, that we won't actually impact on the virus population, but what we're doing is rebuilding the immune system so it can control the virus without antiretroviral drugs. And there, I think most people would agree, in fact, everybody would agree, we don't really know how to measure the immune system's ability to control the virus. So the only way to know whether something is working in that setting is to stop drugs.
And the current cure research, is it also looking at ways to develop a measurement for looking at the immune response, what they call a biomarker, to show that the immune response is kicking in?
Exactly. So, yes. Yeah. So this is a great question. And I think we should go back to the 1990s. So in the 1990s, we were doing what people refer to as body count clinical trials. We give people an antiretroviral drug and see if it prevented people from dying. Those were gruesome studies to do, and they took forever. Then we developed a viral load test that we now use in the clinic. And we learned very quickly that the viral load test tells us everything we need to know about how treatment works and who will benefit clinically and who will not. But in order to develop that viral load test, we had to first show that the viral load on people who are not being treated or even during treatment predicted how people do. So now we are in 2018, and we want a cure biomarker. So what we need is a biomarker that will prove that someone on therapy has been cured. And the only way to do that is to do these studies in which we cure people, stop drugs, and they do well, and then backtrack to figure out if there's any measurements that predicted it. And we're nowhere near achieving that state. So we will probably not have a biomarker until we have a cure. And then once we have sort of a cure, then we can begin to figure out who's cured and who's not based on these biomarkers. It's a vicious circle.
And just for listeners who are catching up with some of the terminology, a biomarker is basically a sign in the body that the immune system is kicking in effectively. And right now, we don't know what sign to look for. And that's one of the goals of current cure research.
Yep. It's a big, big initiative right now, trying to figure out, you know, these biomarkers.
So what needs to be in place before treatment interruption is conducted in clinical trials, given those risks you raised earlier, that people get sick and that they may be infectious?
The most important thing is informed consent, right? In fact, actually, I often think that the intervention that we think will help with the cure may, in fact, be more risky than the interruption. So all the risks that are entailed in clinical trials have to be provided through the informed consent process. And that is the most important part of clinical trials, is making sure that people who sign up are doing it, understanding first that the intervention is not going to be curative. We're not really there yet. And second, you know, that there are a bunch of risks and what they are. And it has to be done in a way that people understand it. So that's the first thing. And then you have to also make sure when you do these studies that people aren't being quote unquote coerced and not under any economic pressures to join some studies simply because there's some money being involved. I think that's also very important. So make sure there's no coercion. Make sure that there's informed consent. Make sure that that the community and some outside groups have reviewed the protocol, that it's an ethical study and needs to be done. Finally, you've got to build in all the safeguards. And we know how to do that, right? When we interrupt therapy, we bring people in once or twice a week. We measure the viral load. And once we get concerned, boom, we pounce. We put people back on therapy.
There's such tremendous interest in cure research is because there's such desire. There's such a strong hope to be cured. People are on treatment for life when they're HIV positive. I've seen some ethicists raise this concern that people will overestimate the benefits and underestimate the risks. And what does that mean for robust informed consent?
This is certainly an issue. At the end of the day, to be honest, we can do everything we can in the informed consent to try to make sure that people are aware that what they're getting into will not be a cure, at least with the current experimental medicine type studies we're doing these days, and that they're risk, and they have to do it for the generally for altruistic reasons. You know, the only really way to ensure that happens is that you actually have an investigator on site who can be trusted. the interaction between the research team and the clinical research investigator and the potential participant, that's where this discussion has to happen. And so you have to have very competent, ethical clinical trialists doing the work.
What does that mean then for the role of advocates?
So in this entire process that we've just described, right, making sure that first and foremost that the clinical studies are ethical, need to be done. That means the community who is most affected has to buy in and say, yes, this is important. So at the highest level, in terms of research that's being funded and how clinical studies are being developed, you really need strong advocates who have the influence to have an impact on the agenda. And then I think at the individual site levels and the individual clinical protocols, you know, it's, I think the advocates should be involved in helping with the informed consent process and helping to educate those in the local community about why the cure work is being done, what the risks are, and who should participate. And I think that's why we need to have a stronger a set of communication between community advisory boards, advocacy leaders, again, from all different communities and the research establishment.
Dr. Deeks emphasizes the need for stronger communication among all the stakeholders, with advocates playing a pivotal role to ensure there's strong support for trials and that they're ethically designed. But a fellow CURE researcher, Dr. Dave Margolis, walked AVAC's Jessica Sahls-Wadel through the factors he's weighed and why he's yet to be convinced that treatment interruption, or ATI, is worth it. One note, when Dr. Margolis talks about viremia, he's referring to the presence of HIV in the bloodstream.
People come at this question in different ways. I think that such studies will ultimately be important to do. I just don't think, given what we know, the assays we have, and the tools or drugs that we, or approaches that we have, that they're very useful. And perhaps there would be a specific study where it might make sense, but I think that our focus should be on something different at this point. So, safety, this is the first point. Yes, I agree. One can show that analytical treatment interruptions can be done in the context of a study in a way that is quote-unquote safe, in that the reservoir size won't change very much, and it probably doesn't matter if it does change very much. Antiviral control can be reestablished in almost every case, if not every case. There are other harms that can happen. One could argue that perhaps they'll be controllable and happen at a very low rate, and the value of doing the study overall is, quote-unquote, still worth it. So I would put safety aside as a debate point at this time. Mm-hmm. The real problem that I have is the information that one would get from such a study. If you go to the clinic and you go have your viral load tested, mm-hmm. you want to know that when somebody tells you it's undetectable, it's really undetectable, and it shows that your therapy is working and it's still going to be working. People control viremia for a lot of different reasons, many of which we don't understand, and so time to rebound is a poorly understood surrogate for anything. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes hard to know what information we would gather from time to rebound and how valuable an extension of that time really is. Importantly, then I think one often also has to think about what is the goal of what we are doing. Are we trying to turn people into controllers, viremic or not? Or are we trying to actually cure people? I personally don't think that it's a valuable goal to turn people into viremic controllers or probably even controllers. Because if you asked me what was best for my health, I would rather take one pill a day for the rest of my life than be a controller, viremic or not.
A controller is someone whose immune system is controlling the virus without treatment, keeping it either out of the bloodstream or at very low levels. Some people do this naturally. Helping other people achieve controller status is one of the goals of some cure research, though it's not a full cure. A viremic controller is someone who has very low levels of HIV in the bloodstream. Margolis points to research that the presence of HIV in the bloodstream or in the reservoir prompts other responses in the body, including inflammation, which can have health risks even if HIV levels are low.
I think there's a lot of evidence that persistent HIV infection has bad consequences, particularly when you're not on therapy. So that's a scientific/philosophical debate. And I've just told you where I sit on that side of the debate. There'll be other people that sit on the other side. They'll talk about how toxic medications are, how we can't give them to everyone in the world, et cetera, et cetera. I would argue with all of those points, but that's the argument. I think that we should be able to demonstrate in a study that we made measurable progress towards eradication, such that we'd made so much progress that now was the time that we had to actually see if we were close to success or not to do an ATI study. So I would take someone and want to show that we had made a biological change in them that was substantial. And then I would also want to know there was a reason to think that I had made their immune system better than it was before, because almost everybody who goes off therapy eventually rebounds. Then I would think, okay, now let's give it a try. But I don't think anybody has a study or a plan that can accomplish even one of those things reproducibly in a significant number of people, such that you'd want to go through an ATI. So that's why I don't think it's time for them now. I hope that there'll be time for them in the future.
So I guess my follow-up question is, what would you say to somebody who said, one, you need to have a treatment interruption to find those biomarkers to understand the immune system better? And number two, what if the immune system needs to see the virus? And so we need to actually take people off of treatment to let them rebound a little, because we need to not just see what our intervention has done, but their immune system actually needs time to see the virus again, to control the virus.
Okay, so that might be one of those kinds of examples where you could have a very carefully selected group of people that had, you know, medical situations where an ATI would be as less risky for them, very close follow-up, you know, very good informed consent, all of those other things, and you could do an ATI. But I think that that would be a protocol review issue specifically. You know, was there sufficient data? So you would know that I gave you A and then B happened, and so now I expect C to be the result. I don't think we should be just putting things into people and not have a measurement that we can say that the effect that we were trying to create happened. Saying we're going to give A and then B and then C and then D and we're just going to stop and see what happens because we'll learn something from seeing what happens. Show me why I should believe that. Show me the data. Show me your assays that they're meaningful and reproducible. I haven't seen any of that.
What do you think is the main interest that community and advocates should know when they're thinking and hearing about ATI studies?
People should know that an ATI study is almost certainly going to result in you going back on therapy. That should be the plan. Your participation and sacrifice in such a study might help advance science. And when you're signing up for this study, somebody should explain to you in really clear terms exactly how they know that they can measure things and have an outcome at the end of the study that other scientists and investigators and doctors and clinicians and participants could understand the result and understand that it moved us forward in some way.
Advocates paying close attention to cure research are also treating the question of analytic treatment interruption with care. Udam Likit Wanawut has served as a community representative on numerous advisory boards related to HIV research in Thailand, including studies on cure.
I think right now we don't have any option how to measure our progress. You know, so I think at the moment treatment interruption is still necessary. But I think having said that, I think we have to be really careful how we do it. You know, I think we can use medical criteria as well as social criteria. For example, social criteria may be whether that person is you have a good relationship with a researcher or not, so we can monitor them carefully.
Likit Wanawut applies the same case-by-case criteria when asked if he has ethical concerns about cure studies that involve both treatment interruption and placebos. This kind of study has been conducted in Thailand. It means some participants in the study get neither treatment nor the intervention being tested.
The issues about placebo are always, you know, is kind of troublesome, you know, challenging even for all the HIV researchers. It's going to be, you know, need more discussion about whether we need placebo or not. We have to consider it together with scientific rationale, what strategy we want to prove, you know, or whether it's not too risky but with not enough scientific justification. I think we cannot decide by itself whether it needs placebo or not. We have to consider all the factors as well. Yeah.
Many things make cure research and the ethics around it complex. But two fellows attending an intensive workshop on cure in Uganda, hosted by AVAC and the International AIDS Society, told AVAC's Sindra Feuer why, as persons living with HIV, they support and are excited by cure research. Sindra spoke with Flavia Namwaya and Moses Supercharger.
And how long have you been living with the virus?
For 26 years now.
And how old are you?
I'm 26, since I was born. Although I've understood that I might still be antibody positive, but still in me as a person who has been living with HIV, when the doctor tells me that I'm in remission, it will be the most happiest thing of my life. Maybe it might not start with us, but for the generation to come, it will surely benefit them. And a cure benefits both the positive and the negative. So we are creating a free generation, and a cure will help us with the burdens of stigma, discrimination, the pill burden, the things of taking drugs every day. The cure is the hope for, I'll say, for HIV treatment.
I want to get cured of HIV personally, but I also want my fellow folks, the 37 million people living with HIV, to also get chance to get cured.
So Moses, though, but you're on ARVs and you're already controlling your virus, so why do you need a cure?
Oh my God. I need a cure because the ARVs I'm taking, that makes me look good. They have challenges. Because, for instance, the drug which I take, it has a very bad side effect. The ARVs are cumbersome. Secondly, the ARVs are very costly. Yeah? We are 1.3 million people in Uganda are taking these medications every day. The third reason why we want the cure, stigma around it, people seeing you pick the medication from the hospital, people see you take medications every day, all that is stigma. We have a challenge here. The last one are the children, really. Uganda has more than 200,000 children on medications. These children were born with HIV. They've been on treatment since birth. So I think we need a cure.
Right now, as advocates, we should start supporting the cure research that is being done. We should start mapping it out and empowering and activating for it through our government policies that we have more of this research being conducted in our countries. Advocates should really come out and be able to acquire this knowledge and pass it on to other people so that our government can understand the importance of this research.
There's a lot of research now going on around cure research, which was not happening 15 years ago. I see a lot of investment, which was not happening 15 years ago. So it will be hopeless for people to invest in money, for researchers to take initiative, and we community, we don't participate. So I'm just acting like an example to fellow advocates that it's our time now to stand up and get involved into the ongoing cure research.
Several studies using treatment interruption are underway now. Others have concluded, and still others are planned, with completion dates stretching out 2 years ahead at least. But whatever the findings, all the researchers agree, these questions won't be going away soon. To learn more, check out the Cure page on avac.org and join us again in August for our next episode of PX Pulse. Thanks for listening. I'm Jean Barron.